In 2003, Nike signed 13-year-old Freddie Adu to a 7-figure contract. But Freddie didn't live up to the hype. He has turned down every single documentary project looking closely at the details of his career. Until now.
People are going to look at everything you did because of the hype surrounding your arrival and what they think you can be.
I'm Grant Wall, and this is American Prodigy, Freddie Adu, from Blue Wire Podcasts.
We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your hosts, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 498. Happy Thanksgiving week to everybody out there. We've got a great show for you today. Andy Martino joins the show again. He was on over the summer. I talked to him for almost an hour. A lot of good stuff in there. He's writing a book about the Astros cheating scandal. So he's got some, yeah, it's due to come out, he said, right around spring training. And so a lot of good stuff in there about that, how the season ended for the Yankees. Mets, the dynamic with Cohen owning the Mets now. I got to tell you, man, I'm excited for the Mets to have a competent owner.
Really? You're excited? Yeah. What if they take DJ LeMahieu away from us? Are you going to be excited then?
No, but
I might blame you now. I might
not to spoil anything. Andy doesn't think that'll happen. But I just think that from like a city buzz type of thing, having both teams relevant and actually legitimately competing with one another, I think could be cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a long way to get to that point, but the fact that they have a guy that's, you know, not being defrauded in a Madoff scandal or, you know, has more money than God, that's a good thing for them. It's definitely a good thing getting unhinged from a really shitty ownership group. That's a good thing. So good for them. I'm glad little brother has a good stepdad now with with a deep pockets. It's good.
Well, at a certain point, like you talked about with the Red Sox quote rivalry, like, I don't know, it's lost its, I need something that's lost its edge. Like I need some buzz. I need some edge in my season.
Yeah. I think it's good. I like when there's competitiveness, because then the fan base is, you know, they get very bitter. The Mets fans are very bitter.
Oh yeah.
So I'm fine with that. They can be good in the National League and do things over there and act like they're the you know, the team in New York. That's great. It's funny. It's cute. It's adorable.
I can see it's already getting under your skin.
Bobby Cano, no longer there. That's a thing. I mean, now that LeMahieu is the market is very much wide open. We talked about him, you know, declining the offer as expected. But I think Robbie Cano not being over there, even though he's not full-time second baseman, still it relieves some money for at least next year.
Are you getting worried about LeMahieu? Like that the Yankees are not going to bring him back? The reports are the Yankees want him back and he wants to be back with the Yankees. So you'd think, okay, what's the problem? Get the deal done.
Bingo, bango, let's get this thing done.
But other teams, Nationals, Red Sox, a couple other teams have been linked to LeMahieu. Maybe the Yankees are not willing to go the length of the contract that LeMahieu wants. The longer it goes on, I think the worse it is for the Yankees re-signing him.
Oh, there's no doubt, because that means they haven't agreed to a deal yet. Yes, that is, it gives them more opportunities for other people to get involved too. The fact that if this is a deal that's not getting done for a 1 to 2 year, which does worry me, that part of it worries me, because the Yankees are absolutely known for not going that extra year or two based on a number or, you know, whatever they have in their brain, a valuation that they have in their brain that they don't move from. Freaking Randy Levine doesn't move from.
I don't think Randy Levine has any.
I think he is. I think he's a
contracts.
I think Randy Levine is a guy that has
no.
He does. He weasels his way into the conversation.
He might poke his head in the conference room, but then Brian Cashman quickly locks the door on his ass.
I don't know. I hope so, but I think that at the end of the day, if it comes down to something like that, if it doesn't happen, if the deal doesn't happen, and it's because of a 1 year option that's not guaranteed, that he gets guaranteed somewhere else and, you know, a few million bucks, it's going to really piss me off.
Yeah,
it's
going to
piss me
bullshit
off no matter what.
That'll be big time bullshit.
You have two consenting parties right now. Make a deal happen.
I'm trying to think of how I want to ask this question. Can you envision a scenario where the Yankees don't re-sign LeMahieu this offseason, but get better?
No.
Like if they make a trade for Francisco Lindor and their plan is Lindor at shortstop and Gleyber Torres back to second base. I mean, I think you can make an argument that makes the Yankees better.
You could make an argument that makes them better. I disagree. You're saying because of the slide over from short to shortstop
Lindor. I think Gleyber Torres becomes a better player, and then you have Francisco Lindor, a switch hitter, great, one of the best shortstops in the game.
Coming off of a bad.
I'm not gonna like it because I still think the Yankees could sign LeMahieu, but I don't think Lindor is like a realistic possibility. But I think you can make an argument that the team is better off for that.
I will not listen to any argument. I will not I will not give the attention to any argument that says the Yankees are a better team with DJ LeMahieu off of the roster.
No, it's hard
for me to entertain that.
So I mean, it's a must then for this offseason not to be a failure.
Yes.
I think in your mind and a lot of Yankees fans' minds, that if DJ LeMahieu is not re-signed, plus some, because you can't just go into next year with the exact same squad that you had this year that wasn't good enough to get out of the division series.
Well, they were so close, so close. They were right there.
I talked about that with Andy.
But that's the thing. Like, we've talked about this so many times that You not only need DJ LeMahieu back, but you need more players like DJ LeMahieu around him that give you a different option, a different look in the lineup.
Balance.
Yes.
That lineup balance.
So if diversity of
styles.
Correct. Bat to ball, essentially. You make contact and find green area good. Those are good things. So DJ LeMahieu, piece number one. But also now compliment him with other people who could make more contact and turn this lineup over, you know, more often without striking out.
It's not like they have five roster holes on the playing side, on the position player side to fill. So
no, but at the same time,
you might have to subtract away from certain areas and add.
Yes, or you improve. Again, I feel like I'm gonna die on this hill, but I do believe that Clint Frazier can be a guy that plays. To more contact, they can be.
No, he can, but he's still. That's the same name. That's the same.
It's the same name, but they're gonna have to. I understand that. I don't think there are that many. There's just not that many great options on the market right now. To be honest, like you look around, you're like, how are we improving? Unless you're getting, you're getting richer via trade in a way that,
it
comes out of nowhere.
Why can't I think of his name?
Michael Brantley.
Left field. Michael Brantley. You knew. See, this is why. Almost 500 episodes. It's like it's like you're in my brain. Michael Brantley.
Michael Brantley is a guy that can improve that for sure. But then you're now also you're getting rid of the guy that I'm trying to die on a hill for. So
you'd rather be right than the Yankees good. I get it.
Well, both is good. I've done that in the past. Michael Brantley definitely gives that look for sure. But it's just not when you look around as far as needs for the Yankees and like where the positions are, that's just not one of them that I'm looking to add an aging guy when I have a young dude that's about to hit his stride that has all the ability in the world. It's just asinine to think about that to me when you're thinking about one that I believe he's ready to make that move, to make that big jump because of where he is age-wise, because of where he is, you know, at bats in the bigs. Like, I think he's had enough under there to figure this thing out. He's figured out the defense. Like, he's shown the ability to get better. All of these things to me are positive for a guy that should have a good amount of growth within your organization.
We're not going to talk long, just Scott and I, because we're going to get to the portion with Andy, and also we gotta go. But quickly before we talk about some other things, Morton signed with Atlanta
for
a season, $15 million.
Yeah, so under the qualifying offer again.
This is now twice that he has signed with another team for really not that much money, and he's still a very useful pitcher. The Yankees have not been linked to him. Maybe he just doesn't want to play for the Yankees and it's a moot point, but
I think there was ties to his family being in Atlanta. There's some family connection there.
Sure. But take that away. Mm-hmm. 1 year, $15 million for Charlie Morton, I think for the Yankees would make a ton of sense.
It's a great deal. I would. That reminds me of the Hiroki Kuroda deal, where you get a very, very like stable guy who's going to come in, probably give you like number three type numbers, but a dependable arm in your rotation that's a veteran. So yeah, it's a good move. It's the Braves definitely won out there for sure. This goes back to some of the other deals that the Yankees had made in recent past, where I don't think there were necessarily players in it. If we find out that they were players in it and they offered a $14 million deal and wouldn't budge, that's going to piss me off. Because that's a quality pitcher that they got at a bargain.
Right. And I mean, it makes the Rays worse.
So, yeah, it does.
So in a sense, that's good for the Yankees. And there's also rumors that the Rays are willing to shop Blake Snell.
Which is odd. Do they just identify that they can't win in a big season? Like, shit, we missed our opportunity.
Yeah, I think what the Rays, the Rays don't want to be late. They rather be early than late.
But they have to do that early. They have to guess when they're going to be early almost, because they can't sit back and wait for these contracts to get to a point where no leverage.
He's already signed to a contract for three more years at $40.8 million. For the quality of pitcher that he is, that is a bargain.
You will get a freaking haul, King's ransom for that.
Yes.
And that's why.
So if you can get like three top 10 prospects out of an organization plus a couple of other like flyers or something like that,
I mean,
maybe even a piece at the major league level.
A controlled.
But if you're the Rays, like, you're looking at this, okay, yeah, we lose Charlie Morton, but we still won the division. We still went to the World Series. We still have confidence in our team. Selling Snell, I think, would give up that. You're just basically punting. Like, you're out. No, they're not punting.
He had a bad year 2 years ago, and they were still very competitive. I think that they believe that.
What are you talking about? He had a.
2 years. I'm not the year after he won the Cy Young wasn't. He didn't have a great year.
Oh,
I think that they believe that
they can win without.
They can. Yeah, they can. They can absolutely fill that void. Look what they did with the bullpen.
Is this a system thing? They're just like, we're gonna plug in different freaky relievers into our system.
Maybe.
And we're gonna get the same results.
Or they feel confident in, you know, however many people that they have in the minor leagues that can come up and do something. Or they can make a free agent acquisition. I mean, they just got rid of Charlie Morton too. So that would be two of their starting rotation down.
Two out of their big three starters.
They have the number one prospect in baseball still. That's going to be, I think he was an A-ball. So last 2 years, whenever the hell the last real season was. So they have prospects still that are coming up. And if they were to get rid of a former Cy Young winner with three controllable years at a good salary for 3 years, that doesn't happen. They're going to get a shit ton of good prospects. So.
And Rice Aroni just got into some trouble in Mexico. I don't really know. I just saw someone put it in our chat.
What did he do? We don't know what he did.
I just saw the headline, something involving his wife and children. I don't know.
Oh, that's very vague.
Rosarino,
in trouble. Rice Aroni.
So, but getting back to Blake Snell, what if Blake Snell went to Rays ownership and said, screw you guys, I want out? Trade.
You're saying leverage now goes away a bit. I don't think the leverage goes away, because there'll be competition. The leverage will be.
What if that's the reason though? They're shopping them.
Oh, maybe, possible.
Like, you don't let me go out there when I'm pitching the game of my life in the World Series.
And there's too much. And I don't want to catch the Rona. And Florida's a bad place to be.
Yeah. I don't want to play in this freaking biodome anymore. Get me out of Tampa.
Yeah. I don't think they lose much leverage, honestly, because the player is just that good. He's coming off of the best appearance he's ever had. All the attention was on that. And then, you know, there's going to be competition for him. So on the marketplace, it's going to be good. It's going to be steep.
All right. So that, you're back home, and that's great news.
Yes.
Kemp was discharged from the hospital
Saturday.
We've gotten emails, from listeners. People reached out on social, over the last 3 weeks that we've been doing the podcast while Kemp has been going through the surgery and you've been in Boston at the hospital. People are very interested, rightfully so. Give an update.
Yeah, so we got, again, I've said this before and I'll say it probably a countless other times, the outpouring of support and just you know, awesome posts, tweets, DMs, messages that I've gotten at other places. Just really, really appreciate it. And to know that, you know, so many people are, you know, involved in Kemp's story is it warms my heart to be the cheesy dad, but he's doing really well. The doctors are very, very pleased with all of the numbers. We had kind of a whirlwind 24 hours where he had some things that happened on his end medically, but thankfully they got through them quickly on Friday night. He was actually discharged on Saturday and we got the green light to travel on Sunday. So we hit the road. We're like getting the hell out of Boston. We got the green light. We're good. Let's go. And we took the plunge. So now we're home. I got to sleep in my own bed on Sunday night, which is
back
awesome.
Back home just in time for Thanksgiving.
Just in time for Thanksgiving to stay at home by ourselves.
Sorry, it's better than staying in a one bedroom apartment in Boston.
Oh, no, it was a studio apartment. Worse than that.
Studio apartment. Yeah.
So no, it was good for sure. And just, he's doing well. He's last night, you could see just like the exuberance come back and just slowly you're starting to see him get back to himself and it's awesome to see. So yeah, thanks for everybody who sent messages and was kind of along the way for this whole thing. We've all been through three of his surgeries now, you know, like that's crazy to think about this whole deal and how many of the listeners have been along this whole journey with us. So
yeah,
yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for this portion. Stay tuned for the rest of the episode. Happy Thanksgiving out there to everybody. We'll try and get back on a normal schedule at some point next week. I don't even know.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. Now that I'm back, we can get on more of a normal schedule. Kind of like
waiting for something to happen. Sign LeMahieu already so we can get on here and talk about it.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you guys then.
Hey guys, 2020 has already reshaped how we work and it's almost over. Businesses across the globe are challenged to be more efficient, which means every single hire is critical and Indeed is here to help. Indeed is the number one job site in the world with more visits than any other job site, according to Comscore. Indeed helps you find quality candidates quickly so you can focus on hiring the right person you need to keep your business going. Unlike other job sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only got to pay for what you need. You can pause your account at any time and there are no long-term contracts. And now Indeed's new way of matching you with candidates instantly delivers a short list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job criteria that you can contact the moment you sponsor a job, making Indeed the only job site that you can move as fast as you do. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates you will see and fast. Try Indeed without free $75 credit at Indeed.com/BlueWire. This is their best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/BlueWire. Offer is valid through December 31st. Terms and conditions apply.
Football is going strong, and that's just one of the many things you can wager on at BetOnline. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still get in on the action. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on every possible chance to win this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than anywhere else. You can still even get in on their season opening bonuses today and start off wagering on wins, division, and championship futures all day, every day. Head to BetOnline today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. They also have things you can bet on like MLB Hall of Fame odds. I got an email about that this week. Some interesting things there. You can also bet on where Theo Epstein is going to take the next job if he's going to keep working in baseball. Go check it out. Don't forget to use our promo code BLUEWIRE at betonline.ag. That's BLUEWIRE, all one word. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. All right, it's great to welcome back Andy Martino of SNY to the podcast. We talked to him over the summer just before the Yankees and Mets were going to play. And it was the weekend, I think they got shut down and they didn't play.
Right.
And then they ended up playing later on. So Andy, welcome back.
Well, thank you. And that is a nice little reminder, as if one were needed, that it was a kind of a weird year.
Yeah.
Both in baseball and in the world in general. It's like, yeah, we're getting excited, hyping up the Subway Series. And then they got a deadly virus, and fortunately everyone was okay, but they didn't play. That's basically the summary.
Yep, and I don't know how you feel covering the sport, but like you just said, trying to hype up the Subway Series. I don't feel like baseball or any sports ever got to the hype that they normally would get in a normal Yankees-Mets Subway Series, or a normal ALCS, or a normal World Series, or other sports, a normal's Masters Week. Normal's Masters Week, that's all you hear about. And it's just, I don't know, sports, I don't know if they've been able to break through in this whole year because of COVID.
Well, the ratings generally about on sports TV ratings certainly bear that out, among other metrics. I'm sure that's true. People haven't been as excited. We might not be the best demographic to speak to that, because I know I was excited to watch the World Series and the playoffs because I love the sport, and I'm sure you were too. But more broadly, yeah, and I would suggest, look, maybe this is being too optimistic about our fellow humans, but maybe that was people having their perspective actually in order this year. We had a deadly pandemic, which we're still living under, of course, and the need to protect ourselves and our families from it. We had a highly consequential presidential election season going on, and we had racial unrest and awakening that led baseball players to literally leave the field, basketball players too, of course, to literally leave the field of play because there were more important things going on. So, you know, as much as we love sports, maybe people by watching less of it actually were spending their time better.
Maybe, yeah. And the whole cliche is you use sports as a distraction. It's an entertainment, just like a television show or a movie is a distraction for a couple hours a night. I don't know. And I think for very good reasons that you all just mentioned, it's not. It hasn't been able to do it for a lot of people. And my interest, as diehard of a baseball and a Yankees fan as I am, my interest in the sport, especially after the Yankees were booted from the playoffs, certainly declined. I think it's a number of different factors. People who are listening know I've complained about certain areas of baseball, the pace of play, all that kind of stuff that I just find it hard to watch if I'm not invested in a team on the field. So I think that played a factor, and then couple that with all those things, and yeah, you're going to have terrible ratings. But how do you think, if you had to give a grade to MLB, how did they handle the COVID season?
I think they would have to grade out really high. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in that way yet, but certainly like a B+, A-. And this is coming from somebody who was extremely uncomfortable with the effort to play. I understood it from a business standpoint. I wanted them to try to play because I understand how many people's careers and livelihoods were dependent on it. John Mozeliak, the president of baseball ops, obviously the Cardinals, had a quote in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch when they were still determining whether they were going to play, which was like something to the, I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, if we even just play one game this year, the amount of jobs that will save will be profound. Now, a lot of jobs were lost in the industry anyway, and careers ruined because of this, but more were probably saved because they played. So I get the economic, same reason I understand why my local restaurant wants to open up, even though it's maybe not a decision I would make to go there. I get why they're trying. You know, it's that balancing act.
Sure.
So I had discomfort with the fact they were playing, and I was just worried. I was like, you know what? I get that you're trying to start, but if this enterprise of trying to play the baseball season kills one person, then it wasn't worth it. And that's something that a Rob Manfred is going to have to deal with as a defining moment in his life, is obviously his legacy. So it was a real high wire act, right? Like, and what I mean by that is, if a player came home, as far as we know, nothing like this happened. If a player came home with the virus, gave it to his, you know, uncle, and the uncle died of the virus, then you shouldn't have played baseball. That's whatever. It's not worth one life.
Of course.
But that doesn't appear to have happened. And the baseball did tighten up their protocols when necessary. They weren't tight enough at the beginning when the Phillies and the Marlins played on a day when the Marlins had the virus, and if too many people appeared to have known about that, and they tightened it up, and they continued to tighten it up, and within some teams they continued to tighten up. Ironically, Justin Turner of the Dodgers sort of at some point in the season wrote this memo to his teammates like, social distance, wear your masks, let's go, let's not ruin this, people are depending on us. And there was a lot of leadership inside the game, and they ultimately came within what, one inning of pulling it off beautifully. And then Justin,
of course,
Turner,
that's the lasting memory, though. It's the last thing we see, yeah, is from a COVID standpoint, is Justin Turner on the field after he tested positive. And
yeah,
that seems like typical MLB in my opinion, that that's what's going to get the headlines, and I understand it. But yeah, you're right. I mean, overall, it was safe overall, in the sense that there were no deaths from as far as we know. Some players got it. A lot of players got it. some players have had to deal with more serious things. I know Eduardo Rodriguez for the Red Sox is still dealing with health complications, and he's a young athlete, and he's still dealing with it 8 months later.
And I think you're right to point out that there are things other than the ultimate result of death that are very bad about the virus, and players, young athletes have certainly had serious effects. Certainly it's possible that family members that have gotten it from exposure to, although we just don't know. So yeah, that's a good point about Eduardo Rodriguez. And with Turner, yeah, look, it was just, had that not happened, had he not come back on the field, I think baseball would have been on the receiving end of a lot of very glowing reviews about how they handled the season, and that tempered it, and it should have. It was a bad look and a bad thing to have happened. So it underscores the complexity of all of this. But still, really, when you look at it, a lot of people were skeptical that everyone knew they were going to start. A lot of people were skeptical that they were going to finish, and they did. So it's something.
Yeah, not everyone played the same amount of games, but they got close enough, I guess. And yeah. I think whatever weekend it was where the Marlins were shut down, the Phillies were delayed, Yankees were traveling to Baltimore because they couldn't play the team they were supposed to, like all that stuff happened, I was like, I don't see how this finishes. We're 10 days in and then we have all this crap going on. I just don't see how you get through it. And they got through it by hook or by crook. I don't know how they got through it. And there's some things still rub me the wrong way. Maybe I'm just too picky. Like after the season, after the season, after they got through it and all that stuff, and then Hal Steimer goes on Michael Kay's show and talks about how the Yankees had such a hard season financially and that they were hit harder than any team in baseball. It's like, yeah, that might be true, Hal, but I don't want to hear about it, and no one else wants to hear about it. The bars around Yankee Stadium don't want to hear about it. The people who rely on Major League Baseball don't want to hear about it. So
I agree with you on that. I think that anybody who's wealthy has clearly less to complain about financially than a lot of other people this year. And it's not a good time and it's not a good look for any wealthy person, be it the owner of the Yankees or anyone else, to say, oh, we lost a lot of money. It's like, yeah, you definitely still have your health insurance and your house and your company. And they did have to lay off people, or felt that they had to lay off people. We haven't seen their books, but for sure, I think that's a good point, that the optics of talking about that publicly are not good for a wealthy person.
Sure. And I believe he was asked directly about the question, so he answered it. I get it. It's just, and also, well, did you lose money or did you just not make as much money as you would have in a normal year? That's another thing that is muddy, I think.
Yeah, and I think there's two ways to answer that question too, which is Brian Cashman's sort of stock answer has been more appropriate than that answer that Hal gave, I think, which has been basically, he will lead every answer about that generally with, we're very fortunate that we're in business. I'm fortunate to have a job. I'm fortunate to have these kinds of problems. It's been a tough year for a lot of other people. I think you can describe the reality of the Yankees are tightening their belts because of COVID. That's fine, but you should say that a lot of people have it worse first. And I think Cashman's done a better job of that than some, actually.
Yeah, Cashman, I think, and Cashman's, I guess this goes nicely into Cashman and Boone's end of season press conferences, which I'm sure you, I don't know if you were on the Zoom or not, but I'm sure you've watched.
Yeah.
And some of the things that I thought Cashman said were a lot more honest than what Boone was saying. Like Boone constantly talking about how close the team is when they haven't made the World Series yet under him. And they just got beat by a division rival in the division series, not even the championship series, I think is a little disingenuous. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just Boone, but what were your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's disingenuous. I understand why it would be unsatisfying. I would draw a difference there. The reason I don't think it's disingenuous is because I think that what defines Aaron Boone in that role, if not as a human, I don't know him in his personal life, but I know him in his professional life, and he has a borderline, if not over the borderline, irrational belief in his players. Like when he was telling us that Sonny Gray was going to be okay, he meant it. I swear to you. Like he, and sometimes that works against him because Sonny Gray was not going to be okay in New York, and it took a Cashman to pull the plug.
Yeah.
His strength is that it's not fake a belief in the people and the players in that clubhouse. It's genuine belief, and players can smell the difference. So that helps him get buy-in from his players, and it leads him to say things that are that don't have the perhaps objective insight that fans want to hear when they're feeling really shitty about the fact that your team just lost again in the playoffs. So I think it was – everything he said was authentic, but then it's up to the fan to decide if it's what they feel a manager should be saying at that time. That's a different question.
Okay.
But well, I don't think it was disingenuous.
Maybe disingenuous is the wrong word. How about wrong? It's just wrong because you got bounced in the ALDS – and you didn't have a second starting pitcher. You're not close if that's the case. If you have one starting pitcher on your roster, you're not close. So I get bothered by those sorts of things because I look at the team objectively and you can complain about the strikeouts. You can complain about the lack of balance in the lineup. You can complain about all these different things. But the reality is they had to try to trick the Rays into winning a series because they didn't have more than one starting pitcher. So I don't know. I don't know how you can say you're close to winning a World Series when that's the case.
All fair analysis. I believe that he truly believes it. I know that after they lost to the Astros in 19, he took it really, really hard, like for a long time, like devastated, because he couldn't believe. Like, he literally, I don't know that he could process that they didn't win the World Series. He's like, we're great. My guys are great. Like, what do you mean we're not? He really, like, I don't think he could quite compute it. Again, like, and I know that was a different year and a different set of circumstances. So I wouldn't disagree that the Yankees were more than one player or one pitcher away or what have you. And his analysis was probably generous, but That's who he's going to be in that job. That he's going to be like just not quite fathoming that his guys who he believes in aren't the best team in baseball. I really think that's like a psychological – I don't know if it's a psychological trick that he plays on himself or just the fact that he's made these deep connections and can't accept anything else, but that's how he is. And now there's another point of it, which is – probably more calculated, which is how's a manager going to position himself in a news conference setting under those circumstances? Well, is he going to say we didn't have enough pitching? That's a shot at his boss, right?
Yep.
So maybe if he thinks that privately, he would be more likely to express that in a meeting. Hey, Cash, can we get a starting pitcher or two? But present a unified front once you're up at the podium. So that's another piece.
Well, see, I actually didn't think that was a unified front because I thought Cashman was much more honest about where the team stands right now in his analysis.
He has a leverage to be. He's the boss,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Plus it's self-criticism, not criticism of someone else. He can say, yeah, we weren't – he said the Rays are better than us because they were, which is an indictment. So Eric Neander put together a better team than I did on a tighter budget. He can criticize himself. If Boone said that, we'd all be like, whoa, you just said that your GM did put together a worse team than the other GM.
Yep.
So that's a calculation. He's got to be like, am I going to make a news story or am I going to tell him that privately?
And this fair? And it all goes back to the, is Aaron Boone a puppet?
Well, puppet is a reductive term.
I couldn't believe he actually said that. I couldn't believe he actually said it. Like when he said that, I was watching the press conference live. I almost did a spit take when I heard Cashman say those words.
Yeah. And there was a lot of Trump memeing that no puppet, you're the puppet. And which is like, it may have been a little bit of you protest too much. Aaron Boone took a job in a collaborative organization. That's why I actually really think that the whole discussion of puppet is not one worth having. I think it's a discussion out of another decade. I'm not criticizing you for bringing this up. No, I'm criticizing it for being a topic a month or two ago. if any fan of any team thinks that, you know, Earl Weaver's walking through that door, or Lou Piniella, or Joe Torre. That's just obviously...
Or Tony La Russa. Oh, wait, he just got a job.
Well, right, and how's that going so far? Exactly. So you... I'll give you a little reporting on how this decision worked to use the opener on, God, my memory's failing me. Game two?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, two.
So my reporting is better than my memory of which game it was, fortunately. But so this could be a little microcosm of the puppet discussion versus the collaborative discussion. So you have the Yankees analysts led by Mike Fishman, doing their work that they always do. And this is like 20 guys in that department or more, like figuring out, okay, what are the matchups? Why don't we like Hap against this part of the lineup? All this stuff. None of this is shocking, but just like you would know this as a fan who pays attention. But they're figuring out all that stuff. Then you've got Tim Nehring and Jim Hendry and the scouting kind of guys thinking like, okay, where do we agree and where do we disagree with the analysis that was brought out? They're all discussing it in a room. Boone will be in that room at a certain point, and the coaching staff, and these guys from the front office will be like, all right, we're thinking that the lane for Hap is this, the lane for Davey Garcia is this, but we're going to give you – so we're going to suggest, and, you know, we're your bosses in parentheses, so we're going to suggest that you do it this way, that you use an opener and then use Garcia this way. But we're not going to tell you what batter to bring in Garcia. We're not going to tell you exactly when to happen. We're going to give you this information over what part of opposing lineup might be best to make that change. And you're going to watch the game, and you're going to combine what we've shared with you with your own instincts and your own eyes, and you're going to decide when to use this information to make a decision that's along these lines. Are you okay with that, yes or no? And Boone might be like, I don't like that. And then they'll hash it out. Boone might win, and his coaches might win some of those arguments, and we don't hear about those. That's one thing I was told during this time. It's like the manager goes toe-to-toe with the analytics guy, and the manager wins. They just play. We never found out about that argument, but that happens too. But I can give you one example. The analytics department did not want Didi Gregorius playing down the stretch in 2019. They thought this guy is not looking good. His first step quickness was one particular issue that their like StatCast data showed. Yeah. Don't play Didi. Boone was like, nope, Didi's a guy. He's my player. He's more old school. They played him. Boone won that one. There's an example.
Yeah, so, and I could see Boone winning a lot of those types of things, like playing Brett Gardner and stuff like that. Where
there you go.
I totally could see that happening. My issue with the analytics being so heavily involved in pitching decisions before first pitch is even thrown is it's almost worse to give all that information and then leave the decision up to him than rather just go into it. I said this a million times after game two, go into it, keep it simple, stupid when you're already up 1-0 in the series. If you're down 1-0 in the series and you have to pull a rabbit out of your hat to try and win the series, okay, I understand a little bit more.
Yeah.
But At a certain point, I just think it's overthinking thing, and it's not just the Yankees. I think Kevin Cash and the Rays, they got bit by their own success in the very end by pulling Blake Snell, and I found, just I want to mention this now because it's relevant. I found Theo Epstein's comments in his exit interview press conference where he talked about the negative impact analytics have had on the game, and he blamed himself. He's like, he looked himself in the mirror. It's like, it's guys like me who have made analytics so prominent in front offices, and it's hurt the aesthetic value of the game.
Absolutely.
And I think it was great that he said that, because it's like, it's finally someone who's like the head analytics guy in all, the whole sport, calling it for what it is. It's certainly valuable, but it doesn't need to be the only thing you look at.
And, you know, Sandy Alderson's been getting at that too. And he's even, you know, exponentially more a foundational figure for analytics in the sport than Theo Epstein. He was literally the guy that first brought a Bill James baseball abstract into a team office in like 1983. Moneyball was accidentally about Billy Bean. If Michael Lewis knew the organization, it would have been about Sandy Alderson. So, and he's been saying things like, lately, like now. He's been saying things like, I want a GM who has empathy and communication, doesn't demonize the other side. So he's been on the competition committee in its various forms that the commissioner not runs, but, you know, under the banner of the commissioner's office, and looking at ways you can make the product more entertaining, whether it's, okay, analytics have created the shifts. There's been a lot of momentum, and I believe Alderson has been very interested in this, of banning shifts. Mm-hmm. So, like, different things on the analytical, on the idea, on the realization from the fathers of analytics in the game that it's hurt the product, right, is definitely a thought that's going around. So I agree with you about that. And it relates back to the Yankees and Rays and all that, like you said. I agree. And then bringing it back to, is Boone a puppet? I think it comes down to, again, he knew where he took a job. He is allowed to have these arguments, but the final step of that is that once you leave the room, once you leave the conference room, or now the Zoom meeting where this is hashed out, present a unified front in public as best you can.
Well, yeah. Well, having said all that, you know, maybe just having a strict puppet would be better for the organization than having a guy that's a puppet 75% of the time and then 25% making his own decisions, because then you have inconsistency. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, yes or no.
I think what they aim for is a process that's collaborative all the time. And sometimes the scouting perspective wins, and sometimes the analytic perspective wins, and they aim for a healthy debate each time. Whether they achieve that, we could probably pull to 10 different members of the Yankees organization who might have slightly different, like any workplace, right?
Well, where do you stand on the way that teams have where the way the sport has gone? Not analytics, because I'm sure you're like most baseball fans who understand analytics are a big part of the game, which is heavily numbers oriented, and you can find ways to use it and find ways to just use your eyes and enjoy the sport. But what are your feelings on how far it's been taken with some organizations?
Well, it's hard to argue with the success, because obviously the Dodgers and the Rays facing each other in the World Series was a victory for that movement. Yeah,
it was perfect for the situation.
Yeah, I think that you can't run a baseball organization now without a heavy investment in analytics, obviously. You'd just be behind, and you'd be ignoring things that are helping other teams win. So I really think, like, as what I was alluding to with Alderson and his current search for an executive, you know, I asked him once, what's the next frontier of analytics? Under the premise of, like, you were the first. Like, you brought on base percentage into the game, like, out of the fringe.
Now that's an old school metric now.
Right. So that was the first thing. Then we went through war. Then we went through this, that, like, there was VORP. There was, there's been a trendy thing a lot of different times. What's next? What's the next frontier? And he said, it's not the next frontier, the final frontier of the analytics movement is not a number. It is a type of human. And this gets to what I was saying before.
Oh my
but
God.
Are
they going to put a number on a type of human? Are they going to assign a value?
It's that empathetic, listening, communicative executive that can make the old school feel valued and the new school have its voice. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying, where I feel that it's gone is toward some good results, but poor communication, a lot of really good people in the industry that have a lot of knowledge being undervalued, either losing their jobs or losing their influence in the jobs they have. And what's needed is a correction where analytics people can say, you guys on the other side of this have something to teach us. And then, maybe on some of the decisions they need to be listened to more. I talked to a source I have in the Yankee organization who really does a good job of understanding both sides, and said, what did you think about the decision to take Snell out of that World Series game? And this person said, you know, it was process-wise, it was a sound decision. But athletes understand that you have a certain gear sometimes where you exceed your typical value, and they can see it and they can feel it. And Blake Snell that day was just operating on a plane that someone else was unlikely to match coming out of that bullpen.
Yeah.
And I've seen the argument that Nick Anderson was just the wrong guy. I don't accept that argument. I think that it was wrong to take Snell out of the game, because you should have listened or trusted the instinct of any athlete, any ex-athlete, and probably Kevin Cash knows that you just you ride that.
For Kevin Cash was a baseball player. He knows, like, he wasn't the best baseball player, but he was around the best baseball player, so he knows that.
He's an athlete. Yeah, he knows. I'm sure. I shouldn't say I'm sure. I haven't talked to him about it. I would imagine that he understands that as an athlete, Snell was the guy you didn't want to face as the opponent that day. But he also understands that he works in an organization where there's a process-oriented decision-making. And he was, you know, managers also, I'm not accusing Cash of this, but managers manage against getting second-guessed all the time too by their bosses and by the media. Like when sacrifice bunting was the thing to do, you bunted because you didn't want to hear why didn't you bunt.
Right.
So there's a little bit of that going on too.
No, I totally understand that. And as far as like the analytics community goes, like I love analytics when it can support or counter things. Like you find out, why is this guy having so much success? You dig into his analytics. Oh, wow. His spin rate on his fastball is tremendous. That's why Chad Green is able to blow guys away at 95 miles an hour when normally a 95 mile an hour fastball gets hit. It's because he has great spin rate. Cool. Great fact. I lose it when the analytics community tries to tell me there's no such thing as clutch or no such thing as hot and cold, because it's still humans playing the sport. So there's still certain pressure situations that even though this guy's numbers against this type of pitcher, say he's going to hit 300, he might not, because it's a certain situation that that analytics just simply cannot predict. It's human element.
Right. You need to, a good leader of baseball ops department needs to really understand the value of both of those arguments and weigh them. And I agree with you on those particular points. If you're a Theo Epstein or a Brian Cash or an Andrew Friedman or anybody, you need to have a couple of people in the room that be like, no, listen, I played. And when you're hot, you're hot.
Yeah.
Just like Snell was in that game. And it's the fault of many in the analytics side over many years that they've just waved that, you don't know what you're talking about. Imagine being in a room with a 30-year-old Ivy League hotshot when you played and being told, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The hotshot might be right about that particular point, but that type of guy in baseball has done a very poor job over the years of being like, you played, you understand this on a muscle memory level that I couldn't. Let's engage on that. Let's talk. And if we still disagree at the end, fine. But I think there's been too much dismissiveness.
Well, if you are, you talk about what Sandy Alderson is talking about, the next wave, where it's someone who can blend it and manage each side, then maybe that's the perfect storm, perfect recipe for where it's going. Maybe we have gone too far in one direction, and in the past we've been too far in the other. Maybe we can get in the middle. And because it certainly wins games over a regular season. Like, there's no question about that. And then you see certain situations in the postseason where it blows up. And those are the ones that get the most attention.
Right. When and just to put a bow on it, when the many, many decisions that are analytics based over the course of that postseason don't get attention because they worked. So I guess that's the other side of it. Yeah. But you're right.
That's life.
All things in moderation.
So I know there's a lot of rumors about Theo taking the Mets job sometime next year, I guess, because he said he's going to take a year off. But now Cohen's officially, he's taken over the Mets. He's made some changes already. How do you see it going with Cohen in the first couple of years?
First couple of years, he's giving Alderson the opportunity to shape the organization. He chose Alderson as his main guy, his point person in the baseball industry to lead him through that process of that transition into owning the team. Alderson's got a 2-year contract, might stay longer. So the next couple of years, it'll be a lot of trust for Alderson to fill out that organization and do what he thinks he should do. That was a choice to make of Sandy Alderson. Cohen could have tried to get Cashman. He could have tried to get Theo. He could have tried to get, gone. The Dodgers got Andrew Friedman. Like, there's a lot of ways you could go with that top job, and he chose Sandy Alderson. So that's in whose image the team will be in the short term. And if they really hire well, as they hope to, Alderson will hire a GM who can grow into then just continuing that path after Alderson retires. He's 73 years old. That's not going to go on forever. So that's how the next couple of years, from a front office perspective, play out. From a player perspective, look, Cohen set a very Steinbrennerian goal of winning the World Series in 3 to 5 years.
That's right.
He's willing to spend the money to pursue that. They're in on George Springer right now. They might be in on a Bauer. You're going to have to get used to
LeMahieu now that Cano's not playing next year?
That I don't see. That's more rumor than fact. LeMahieu's got a lot of interest. I don't think the Mets are one of the teams that are particularly interested in him. But look, more broadly, what you as a Yankee fan will have to get used to, I guess, is not writing off the Mets on the big targets. If it were a year ago, it would have been like, okay, the Yankees want Cole. Other teams on Cole include the Dodgers, the Angels, the Mets. You know, it's just like they're going to be in that conversation and get some of those guys.
So I remember reading a story about George Steinbrenner where he exploded like in the early 80s because the Yankees lost a spring training game in embarrassing fashion to the Mets. He just could not stand to lose to the Mets. It's all he cared about because he was compared, right? Steinbrenner wanted back page headlines. Is Cohen not that crazy, but is he a type of guy that will measure himself against the Yankees?
Against the Yankees? I'm not sure. Like directly against the Yankees, I don't see signs of that. In fact, there's a bit of a connection. I mean, the Yankees voted for his approval when it wasn't a sure thing. The relationship between like the ownership, Randy Levine's side, like Steve Cohen, his associates, I hear is quite good right now. Could be a honeymoon phase, but it's quite good. I think he'll be emotional in terms of wanting to win and wanting to win championships. And I think what's unique is defining success by championships, which, believe it or not, is not the norm in this business. Because if you look at the teams that are regarded, I think more broad, like if you were to say who are the most respected organizations by other organizations, you would say the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Indians, and the Rays. Five teams, most respected.
Indians? I'm surprised to hear the Indians that. Yeah.
Just because they're smart, process, they do so well. All the pitching they develop, they do so well with limited resources, all that stuff. Those are the front offices that are regarded as the best inside the game. Of those five teams, how many championships in the past 11 years?
One.
And zero until last month.
Yep.
So they're not trying to win championships. That's not how they define success.
It's great that you brought that up because we actually just had a mailbag question on our last episode about sort of like how do front offices measure return on investment? And you look at it, and if it's just based on World Series, then no one's getting a return on their investment, except maybe like the Giants because they've won three World Series in the last decade. Mm-hmm. But it's teams that get to the playoff consistently and win multiple series. Have won multiple playoff series. That's really where you start to see all of the salary you've put into the team start to give something back as far as, okay, you didn't spend nearly as much to win these seven playoff series as some other teams have spent to win one playoff series. I use the Angels have spent like fourth or fifth most in baseball since 2010, and they've made the playoffs once. That's a horrible return on investment.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I think probably in terms of TV ratings for their RSNs, ballpark revenues, being in contention every September but never winning a championship is a better economic model than what the Giants or the Red Sox do.
It's the old producers theory.
Yeah, right. So right. But it's an interesting analogy, actually, making me think about that. So Cohen now is coming in just like, what are you talking about? I won in business.
Right.
I won.
I'm wondering if this is the type of guy he's going to be. And
well, yeah, we've seen signs of that already.
Great.
He's very public so far. He's extremely online. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, but he's like up in the mentions of Mets fans. Like,
oh yeah, it's great. I mean, joking about Bobby Bonilla Day. I've seen a shift, and I'm not a Yankees fan that despises the Mets. I think baseball is better in New York City when both teams are relevant and both teams are good. Mm-hmm. That's when it's the most fun.
Well, they'll be relevant. I think the Mets have found a way to be relevant every year, often not for good reasons, but I think they'll probably be relevant, and they'll both be likely competitive most years. So that I agree with you. That'll be fun. That, there's nothing more fun in this town for a baseball fan than when those two teams are facing each other in a big Subway Series or just, you know, I want to say battling for the back pages. Sadly, that's not as much of a thing anymore. As an old newspaper guy, I wish it was. But, you know, whatever it is, battling for attention or supremacy, that is fun. And that's without it being anti-Yankee. That's clearly what Cohen has in mind, is to be a winning organization, be relevant.
But you gotta take the Yankees off the fictitious back page in this sense. So
yeah, well, that's true.
In that sense, you gotta measure yourself against the team across town. Now, and I understand it's not a black and white thing. It's a gray area, and he's measuring himself based on a number of other different factors. But you know, the Mets have, it's not like they've had no success over the past bunch of years. I mean, they went to the World Series. The Yankees haven't been to the World Series. Right, exactly. Right. But other than that, they've from a distance really kind of been a disaster. So,
I mean, they have a lot of, as an organization, they've tended to put their foot in their mouth, obviously, a lot. They've had these catastrophes happen. I think there are certainly times when something happens to the Mets that if it were to happen to the Angels or the Indians, it would be like, you know, it does feed into a pre-existing perception of
New York City,
but it's there.
New York City, baby. That's the thing. You're going to play in New York City. You're going to get more attention. That's just the reality.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And they'll obviously try to be, they'll try to change the subject and change the reputation. Alderson spoke at his introductory news conference and his return here recently of like wanting to have, he said, the Mets are a storied franchise, but the stories haven't always been good. We want to be an iconic franchise. And I thought that was an interesting distinction to draw.
Yeah, that is. Last thing I want to talk about, because I know you're working on the book about the cheating scandal. What were your thoughts on Hinch and Cora getting jobs immediately?
I thought that it was fine because, number one, if you were to apply a broad standard to the industry, players who cheat and get suspended do have an opportunity to work again if the market allows it. You can get a drug suspension or even multiple drug suspensions and then get another contract if you're a good player. Now, right, that's maybe cynical. And a counter argument that someone brought to me on this was like, so just because other people are bad means more bad is okay?
I
get that. But the reality is that, cheating aside, Hinch and Cora are really good baseball guys, really good contemporary managers who could blend the analytics with the gut thing, communicate pretty well with players. And I think both have done a decent job of acknowledging their mistakes in an earnest way. So I don't really see the argument for blackballing them for the rest of their lives. And, you know, they were immediately desirable because they're good. And look, you give any GM truth serum about a steroid player and they'll be like, just don't get caught, please. And be like, use whatever makes you good and pass the test. So it's not an ethical industry in that way anyway. So why would this be the line?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. It's that baseball, they talk out of both sides of their mouth on cheating scandals, because on the one hand, they try and make such a big deal about the Astros cheating scandal, calling it the worst, you know, basically the worst scandal that's happened in our sport as far as from a team cheating perspective in the modern era. They immediately suspend these guys for a year. Lunau gets suspended for a year. But then it's like a year, but they didn't really go full in with some of the penalties. I mean, they got draft picks lost. What was it, $5 million, which,
yeah,
I mean, Crane is going to find behind his couch. Like, so on one hand, it's they're saying it's severe, but they're not punishing like it's severe. And then a year later, to the day that AJ Hinch last managed, he's got another managerial job. So, again, I understand why they have managerial jobs, but which is it, baseball? Do you care about cheating or do you not care about cheating? And I don't know.
Care is an interesting word. They care.
Like you just said, they care about getting caught. They care about getting caught.
Yeah, as an industry. And I'm not talking about Rob Manfred. I'm not talking about any team. I mean, sort of, when we say baseball, sort of talking about the whole culture of players, executives, fan base, just the whole thing. Right. I think fans too, like if I told you that the entire 2009 Yankees team was on steroids, you'd probably be like, okay, they still won. I don't want to assume how you would feel about it, but a lot of fans.
I would say, yeah, that makes sense, considering A-Rod was there, Cano was there, Melky Cabrera was there.
Right.
Clemens probably left something from, I guess it was a new stadium. So I guess that his packages didn't get redirected to the new stadium. Yeah. I mean, I get it. I'm kind of numb to the steroids thing at this point. If you had told me the day after the 2009 championship, they were all on steroids, I would have cared a hell of a lot more than I do now.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't know about A-Rod till later then. So it didn't spoil your celebration.
Was it that off season?
You can assume that when someone is caught, it's
no, but like I'm trying to remember when did he initially get popped? I forget.
He initially got popped before the 2009 season.
Okay.
Regarding a 2003 test.
Right. He did that interview.
He first met Tony Bosch in 2010.
I'm sure you've seen Screwball. Have you seen Screwball?
I have, and I've done some of that reporting myself on the whole A-Rod MLB thing, and A-Rod. In the process of sort of the back end of all these mea culpas about his earlier use was cultivating Bosch and getting that going. Mm. So you draw whatever conclusions you want about the interim. Yeah, I think it's fair at that point to think about that. But at any rate, it's a person with a strong moral compass would probably object to this discussion and what we're saying by saying none of this is okay. And let's start with Hinch and Cora and clean it up there and drug cheats going forward and the whole thing. And I appreciate that perspective, but it just the industry being what it is and those guys having a proven track record, and nobody thinks that they were only good at what they did because of cheating.
Right.
I
don't think that at all. I've said that a dozen times. They could have won the World Series without it. Might have helped them win the World Series, but
well, they could have. They were good enough. It's another when they won in seven games by a razor thin margin. It is an interesting, unanswerable question. But to your, I know what you're saying.
Yeah,
they're
talented. It's not like they went from. I know they were below 500 this year, which is maybe hurting my argument, but then at the same time, they were in the ALCS. So
yeah. Hinch's weakness as a manager was not in anything that, you know, they were good enough. They had the talent. They won. They might have won without the cheating. Who knows? His weakness was, why don't you say anything if you didn't like it?
Yeah.
And if I'm interviewing him, if I'm the Tigers and I'm interviewing him for that job, I definitely want to know that he grew out of that. And like, if something bad happened, now would you step up? Would you say something? Would you have the guts to say something? And hopefully he was asked that in an interview. But if he answered it satisfactorily, I would consider hiring him because going forward, he's good. Alex Cora just got a great feel for the game. He did something wrong. He crossed the line. During that interview process with Chaim Bloom and the new Red Sox management, he was asked, I can tell you, he was grilled on that.
Right, because didn't Bloom not necessarily want Cora back? He was.
I don't know if it's that. I just think that he probably needed to be satisfied that this wouldn't happen again. Because whether or not Chaim Bloom cares about sign stealing, he knew that Jeff Luhnow's career has been ruined. You know, you can't have that happen on your watch anymore.
Right.
So they had to be sure that Cora had learned from that and wouldn't try to pull anything again. So if you're hiring, if you got that cleared up, if you're confident he's not going to do it again, then look going forward. He's a good choice to lead your team. So I guess, you know, I understand the hires and I think that what my book's kind of about, among other things, and what fascinates me about this situation is the basic question of how three decent, truly decent human beings, Carlos Beltran, Alex Cora, and AJ Hinch, got caught up in the worst baseball scandal in a long time.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting to me. So baked into that premise is that they're all decent people. That's what I think.
Nice. Do you know when it's coming out?
Should be sometime early next year in the spring. I think everything in public, originally we'd hoped a little sooner. It's done. Everything has been pushed back a little by obviously COVID. But by early but at the very latest, early next season, it will be out and published. And
very cool. Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. It's fascinating because you peel back the layers and there's more and more.
It's so fast.
You think Beltran will get another job?
I can't even tell you. I don't know because he doesn't have that track record. It wasn't a particularly well-reviewed hire in the first place before we knew about this stuff because I liked the hire. I like him. I think he had a lot of growth potential in that job. He's also a very reserved, shy introvert in a lot of ways. He's really good with players and he would have been great that way. But this year when the pandemic happened, when Black Lives Matter finally made its way into the game, I found myself thinking, I'm not sure Carlos Beltran would be comfortable speaking to these things in a news conference. He's a private guy.
Yeah.
So
I didn't think about it in that sense. Like I thought about it from I know people love Carlos Beltran and say he's a great teammate and all that kind of thing. So I figured
he's got the
Hall of Fame playing resume that not many managers have. So that sort of can command respect right there.
Yes.
So I found it interesting from that standpoint, but those are good points as far as like Cora's not afraid to speak out and he wasn't.
Right. Or skip the White House visit when they won the World Series. Right. Beltran's just more, when he's in a good mood and when things are going well, he's extremely outgoing and wonderful. And I mean, he's a great person in a lot of ways. And I've been fortunate to get to know him a bit. Over many years, but when something's bothering him, like I remember when I would cover him as a player, you could always tell if his knee hurt because if he felt good, he'd talk to you for an hour. If his knee hurt that day, he was surly, grumpy, and he wouldn't give you the time of day because it wasn't about you. It was that he's sort of like an introvert.
Yeah.
So I think that was something that. That is something that might impact whether he gets another job or wants another job. But he's a lot of ways that he could be good. Like you said, he's a good teammate, great teammate. He has a deep love for other players. He really just wanted the job to like help, to contribute. He's a service-minded person. He does a lot in Puerto Rico for causes that some of which you know about, some of which we don't. And he's just like, I'm rich. I don't have to work again, but I want to help these younger players. That was truly a good part of his motivation to seek that Mets job. So I think all that speaks well for him, but there's only 30 of those jobs. So I don't know. I just don't know.
Right. And there's so many, cause I know he was a special advisor to the Yankees, I think the year before that. So there's certain ways that the Yankees have 100 special advisors, but there's certain ways you can have your fingerprints on an organization and go to spring training. You could show up when you want, you could leave when you want. Being a manager it's a 12-month job, obviously, but like really, it's a 6-month at 24 hours a day kind of job.
Yeah.
When you're that rich and you're that successful, is like you got to be wired a certain way to accept that job.
Yeah, and he got himself to a place where he was that guy who would accept that job under those circumstances. But we'll never know how it would have actually played out when he was. This is a little nugget, like a little paragraph in my book. But I'll share it. Just in the background on him, when he first got to the Mets as the big free agent signing in 2005, David Wright's the young star. Beltran connects with David Wright, seeks him out. He's like, let's be the leaders of the team together. Let's get to know each other. Let's work. We're going to work out together all the time. Wright's like, great. And they're friends and they start working out together all the time. But then Beltran starts getting booed. The press is tough on him. The whole New York thing isn't going great. And he just kind of ghosts Wright, and they're not close anymore, and they're not working out anymore. And Wright's kind of like, okay, I guess I'm not going to get to know this guy. And that's how it kind of played out.
Interesting.
That's the other side of him.
Interesting. Yeah, you get certain nuggets like that about players, but yeah, I don't know. It's not something I would have thought Beltran would have done, but yeah, you never know.
He's younger then, different circumstances, but I'm just saying that's how he can withdraw into himself a little bit. And I think that's what happened after the scandal too, is that Cora and Hinch and Luna all had their strategies to try to kind of go out there, give interviews, get new jobs or what have you, sue the Astros, all these things. And Beltran just closed it up with his family and has not been heard from.
Right. Yeah, because he was a player on that team and he got lumped in with the coaches and the managers and all that stuff. Probably unfairly, even if he was the leader of the players, making sure that the camera was in place and the the station was in place to steal the signs, he's still a player. And people kind of forgot that, I think, in the whole thing.
He was in the middle ground, too, with help with that and representation. The union sent legal counsel in with the players you interviewed, Astros players that went in for the investigation. Yeah. And they did send a lawyer in with Beltran because he wasn't an actor.
He's no longer in the players union.
Huh. So he didn't have the same resources, and that might not have necessarily been fair. The decision to put his name in the actual commissioner's report was one that took him and I think a lot of people by surprise, and really the game that he had devoted so much to slapped him down pretty hard over that. He brought it on himself. He cheated, but there was a line in the commissioner's report. So it was like several players, including Carlos Beltran, and that little that was a de facto punishment, because once that was in the report, he's not managing the Mets this year.
Right.
And I mean, it wasn't discipline, but it was. And
so do you think if he didn't have that Mets job in that offseason, his name gets mentioned in the report?
I don't know the answer to that, but I wouldn't be surprised if him or people close to him would suspect that. I'm not being cute. Like, I don't have a direct answer. It's an interesting question.
Yeah. Because it just seems like, from what you've said, that because he was now in one of the 30 positions as manager in the sport, baseball had to treat him differently than if he was just a retired player or a special advisor to the Yankees or maybe even a bench coach or a third base coach somewhere.
Maybe. I have to leave my reporting on that kind of leaves that at a question, but it's a question that's certainly been asked.
Cool. Well, good stuff. I appreciate all the time. Always fun to talk to you, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Yes, sir. You too. Thank you for having me.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.